Very recent happenings have just convinced me that I should make these tapes. But it was yesterday when Dr. Wisniewski very broadly hinted that I should do so. I felt that it was an intuitive request on his part. And then the day before that, Ann Mesrick came and we got into a discussion about doing these tapes of my Baba stories and my experiences of Baba in my life. And so I'm going to start and just talk to the tape recorder. These items will probably be out of context perhaps or out of date. I mean, they're not synchronized. They'll just be what comes to my mind as I lie here all crippled up, and the things that I think of. I suppose in order to tell the story in some semblance of order, I would tell you that my dear Peggy first learned about Baba by seeing his photograph in a Sunday paper in Washington, D.C. in 1931 or 32. She was with her mother in the recreation room of their house and cut the picture of Baba out of the paper and pointed it out to her mother and said, "Someday, I'm going to meet this man." 20 years later, on May the 17th, 1952, that wish was fulfilled. I came along much later, and Peggy and I met in 1942. And the circumstances of that meeting are quite amusing and synchronicity something. I mean, so many things happened that was so unusual, and so I guess the best way to illustrate that is to tell the story. Just out of boot camp, my platoon was granted a 3-day pass or 72-hour liberty. And since we had come from the city of Washington and now stationed in Norfolk, we decided individually to go home to Washington and maybe meet some old friends or have a few drinks or just whatever might happen. We had nowhere else that we preferred to go. So on arrival in the city, I decided to see if I could find Jim Bird, who was a shipmate of mine, and in fact we enlisted at the same place and time, late December 1952. Sorry, 1942. So I went to the International Club, which was a little, very respectable, small club next door to the Earl Theater building. I have no idea what's there now. But I went there to looking for Jim and found that he was not on the premises, and so several of his employees told me that he might be found up at the 400 Club. The 400 Club was a small, non-ambiance room that was large enough for a dance area and tables and chairs around the periphery. It was a nice, clean, well-lit place with decent people. I looked through the door, and as I looked to my left, I saw this lady gesturing for me to come to their table. And so curiosity got me, and I walked over and see what she wanted. Seeing my shoulder patch, she remarked, "I see that you're in the CBs." I said, "Yes, ma'am, that's true." She said, "My son is in the CBs, and I don't know where he's gone. And I'm worried sick about him. And he was in the 1st Battalion, is in the 1st Battalion." Well, I said, "I was in the 1st Battalion, but the day before they shipped out of Norfolk, I was put into the nucleus of the 2nd Battalion. And unless your son falls out of bed or gets sick some other way, you have nothing at all to worry about. He's well over thousands of miles from any enemy action. And he's at American Samoa in Funafuti." Well, you can imagine the load that was lifted from this mother's heart. She almost leapt out of the chair and invited me to have a drink with her and the 6 other ladies, young ladies, that were sitting at the table. She was obviously the chaperone. And in those days, chaperone was not frowned on as a practice. So I sat down beside this lady, and I don't know that she even told me her name, and I ordered a whiskey sour. But before I could finish it, and that doesn't take very long, a gentleman walked up behind me and tapped me on my right shoulder, and I turned my head to the right and bent my neck so that I could see what was behind me. And I just simply saw this man's face sort of upside down, as you will. And he said, "Would you do me a favor, sailor?" I said, "Yes, if I can. What is it?" He said, "I'm on a dance with a lady in my party, and my wife, being pregnant, is sitting it out. Would you sit with her? I don't want her sitting alone." I said, "Sure." So I excused myself from the lady and her friends and walked over to the table. Now, this lady was sitting on sort of, well, it was a bench, with a small table in front of her and a chair in front of the table. So instead of sitting in the chair with my back to all the activities in the room, I just simply walked around the table and sat on by her side, on her right side. It was only a matter of a few minutes. I don't remember the pleasantries, the introductions, or whatever. But it was a very short while later that I, looking at her, wearing a wide-brimmed black lacquered hat, matchless red hair, flawless complexion, hazel eyes, but a beautiful expression, a sweetness, a beautiful inner light that I didn't recognize at the time, if that's what it was. I was not only attracted to her physical beauty, but I was attracted to her inner beauty. And I told her, "You know, you're the most charming person I've ever met." Now, it was rather strange that I would have said that to a stranger, but I just said it because it had to be said. Moments later, I asked her for her phone number, and I was not mildly surprised to learn that she would give it to me, a sailor, you know, that she had never met, but she did. Second coincidence. So after a short while, I would suppose after the dance music stopped, perhaps I left her side and went on my way, assuming that this man would come back to the table to his pregnant wife. Now the scene changes until a lot later. I wrote her two cards or letters when I was overseas, very formal sort of things. And when I got back to Washington, I called her. It was really more strange than ever that I had kept that phone number all that time. And much to my great joy, she was available, she had not been married, and she had not been pregnant. And so we got together, and that was the beginning, so to speak, of a very long, very fruitful, very happy married life. Seven years of married life, I might say. We started out by just dating. We'd go down to Kennedy Street and see a movie, or take a walk through the neighborhood, which in those days was very nice. But most of the time we'd just spend the evenings together with her mother. This was the first time that I ever had a real family relationship, which I shall never forget. One day, Scotty, Peggy's mother, suggested to her that I come to their house to live, explaining that it wasn't right that I should have to take a bus all the way downtown to where I was staying, or maybe miss the last bus and have to walk for miles to get to bed. And so I wasn't there during that conversation, but apparently Peggy agreed. This is rather amusing because in many, many years later, when I would be told about a couple living in the same house and not being married, I was very hard-nosed about that. I thought that was bad. And I had already done it. I had my own bedroom and my own bath. I did all the housework. I painted, I repaired, I cut grass, I did everything that I was obligated, at least in my feeling, to do as a token of thanks and gratitude for this first-time family. I love Peggy's mother very dearly. And so the three of us had an idyllic life together. Scotty would be home all day. After my work out in Maryland, I would drive down to Elizabeth Arden's or the Shoreham or wherever Peggy was working at the time, pick her up, bring her home, and we'd have a nice dinner together. Neither one of us had any intentions of marriage. Peggy's first husband, who was over at Shepherd Pratt in Baltimore, having suffered a brain tumor, was not at all normal. They had since been divorced, but she took care of his expenses there, nevertheless. So she was not concerned about marriage, and I was not concerned about marriage because for the simple reason I had nothing to offer a woman. I had no dowry, so to speak. I had no education, I had no money, I had no social prestige, I had no academic laurels. I was in pretty bad shape. But Peggy never allowed me to feel, even during those early days when I worked at menial jobs and she was very successful, she never let me feel that I was less than the best. This was her way. She was the essence of compassion and kindness. I think if she had ever said anything in that regard to embarrass me, I couldn't have coped with it. But anyhow, after I don't know how long really, we just were so happy together, and somehow decided that that was what we wanted for the rest of our lives. And so, lo and behold, one morning, getting into the car to drive to Rockville to get married, little Scotty standing on the porch waving a hanky, the little choker on, called out to us, "I wish I could go with you." And Peggy said in my ear, "Don't you dare." Peggy, knowing that I loved Scotty so much that would have been no impediment to me to have her with us.